This is January 19th, 2010, and this is Religion 351, Paul and his letters. And we're discussing the rhetoric belief systems in the Mediterranean world into which Paul went, and asking the question, what did Paul do to bring Christianity into that environment so that Christianity became a very successful religion throughout the Roman Empire within 300 years. 300 years is a long time. But the first century, that time when Paul began, sometime around 35 or 40 of the Common Era, until Paul's death around 64. There's something like a 30-year period, three decades in which Paul himself was working. But Paul was never a disciple of Jesus. But others were disciples. And first he, as you know, opposed Christianity, got a letter from the high priest in Jerusalem, because Paul was a Jew, a very fervent Pharisaic Jew, got a letter that allowed him to find any Christian and put them in prison, get them locked in prison. He was so against them. But then, through a conversion experience, somehow in the midst of this, he felt he was confronted not simply with a voice from God from the heavens, but the voice of the resurrected Jesus Christ, okay, who says, why do you persecute me? This is in the book of Acts, the way it's told, and Paul tells it in his own way in Galatians 2. And then Paul became a convert in this emerging Jesus movement. Right? Now, if you know anything about religions, converts are often the most aggressive, the most vigorous, the most unrelenting. They just don't give up. If a person is, if their family has been a part of this religion for, you know, for many centuries and they're born into it, a person is often just not that fervent about it. But if they have moved from one kind of religious family location into a emerging religious movement, they're often really fired up and going, yeah, maybe some of you are kind of like that now. Or if not, you know some people like that. Well, Paul was a fired up member of this new emerging movement. Now, he understood the movement to be Jewish. He was Jewish. But it was a special branch of Judaism that believed that Jesus Christ was the Messiah who had come to Judaism. Okay? And Paul never gave up his Jewishness, but he really changed a lot of things as he kept focusing on Jesus, who came as a Messiah who was not powerful, but a kind of Messiah who was killed, buried, and that should never happen to a Messiah. Messiah should be very powerful to actually destroy enemies, drive them back. But then the believers said that God did not leave Messiah in death, but raised him up, in fact, raised him up into the heavens so that he exists there in heavenly form and can even appear and will come decisively in the future. And this became the new branch of Judaism during the first century, namely the Messianic branch of first century Judaism that then competed with Pharisaic Judaism that kept focusing on Moses and Torah. So you had Torah Judaism and then you had Messianite Judaism during the first century. And Paul became one of the leaders in this new branch of Messianite Judaism of the time, while other colleagues of Paul, who were Pharisees, became leaders of the Torah Judaism that would now start living in and adapting to, finally, the destruction of the Jerusalem temple when they no longer had their center after 70 of the Common Era. That's like 6 years after Paul was killed. The temple was in existence in Jerusalem all the time during Paul's life. But about 6 years after he was killed, the Jerusalem temple was destroyed. Now that was good for Christianity. Because they could argue that God had decided to transfer a lot of the saving activity that went on in the Jerusalem temple to the houses that were the body of Christ throughout the Mediterranean world that were related to Jesus the Messiah, whom God had raised from the dead. Okay? So Christians use the argument that the priestly functions that went on in the temple were now to go on in the houses that were worshiping Jesus, and they had rituals that they developed, like the Last Supper tradition, etc., to nurture this Messianite Judaism, using the Hebrew Bible and remaining deeply embedded in biblical things. But then they started moving out into the broader world that is sometimes called the pagan world, with the pagan gods out there, whatever word you use, the worship of people like Zeus, Aphrodite, heroes like Hercules or Heracles, and then the heroes who would come in, the Greek god Asclepius. Religious belief systems and their rituals, in other words, are populated with gods, goddesses, and heroes. Right? Now, the first key thing that Paul was doing was changing the population that you talk about. Instead of Zeus and Apollos and others, if instead of Zeus, Aphrodite, and then Hercules or Heracles, the people that are the heroes now of this tradition Paul was bringing in are people like Abraham, who was called like a prophet, Moses, the prophet, Samuel, who's a priest prophet, King David, and then prophets like Amos, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Hosea, Michael. In other words, we will discover as Paul starts to talk about Jesus and God, we discover on page 49, well, let's start with page 48 here in Retzel's Letters of Paul, of 48, when Paul is talking about Christianity, he starts talking about a Messiah figure, a special kind of king. So instead of King Cadmus of Athens or a lawgiver ruler like Solon or something, Paul starts introducing these other personages, other people. And so you get on page 49 at the bottom, Paul is talking about Moses, and then he talks about Jeremiah. Well, what we are getting in a sequence from Abraham to Moses to Jeremiah and to Elijah is a prophetic storyline. So Paul goes out with a prophetic storyline. So he can say, a long time ago, God started calling prophets. What is a prophet? Someone who God confronts. And then what does God... He speaks to this prophet. And what does he tell this prophet?
Like in Jonah didn't go there, then didn't tell those people, like God wanted him to tell them the whole city or people could have been destroyed.
Okay, now that's very much the key.
Like Isaiah.
Like Isaiah.
Like first chapters of Isaiah. Everything's going to go bad if you don't fix yourselves.
And so what does the prophet have to do?
Confront the people.
Confront the people. Do the people like it?
No.
So the prophet's going to be rejected. And so one of the first prophets is Moses. So what did God do to Moses? What's the means by which he should lead him out? Tell him the word of God. Okay, the word of God is something given to a prophet. The prophet has a requirement to go and confront someone and say, hey people, you've got to do this, or you have to do this. So it's a confrontative word. And the people aren't going to like it. They're going to reject it. And so part of the prophetic storyline is that prophet is rejected for taking this word that God gave to that prophet and said, hey, you're the one. You go, you know, Moses says, hey, not me. Don't send me. You know, and Isaiah says, no, not me. No prophet ever wants to go. And that's smart. You don't want to go because you know you're going to get bashed. People aren't going to like you because you're stirring up their regular activities. And you're saying things have to change. And God says it. So that's the prophetic story. Now, what about the future? You always think prophetic means future. Well, this creates a future and pushes the future forward. So there's much more to a prophetic storyline than simply, this will happen in the future. That's only a little bit. It's rather, you go and you confront and you've got to change or else things will go bad for you. But in the context of things going bad, some good things will happen. Now that's how the future unfolds out of prophetic. But the prophetic storyline pushes history forward in such a way that it creates a future. And it says, in the future, things will be bad for you unless things change. But in the future, someone good will come and lead you. You need to identify that person and follow that person. And that's how the prophetic storyline works. Well, this is how Paul began to change the storylines of Greek and Roman myths and stories. Instead of Hercules going on his labors or Zeus doing something, those were the stories that interested people in the Mediterranean world. And Paul is saying, no, those aren't the stories. Let me tell you about Moses. Let me tell you about Adam. Let me tell you about Abraham. In other words, they replace the Greek and Roman myth stories with prophetic storyline that in which there's a call of a prophet, there's confrontation, and then there are results which regularly include bad times for the prophet. Okay? The prophet is rejected. So this is no happy life. And Paul says, hey, you're all called to go forth. Now, and so that's good news. It's good news. You know, should I tell you the good news first or the bad news first? You know, it's good news, bad news, because, I mean, the bad news is this is not going to be no easy road for you. The good news is, hey, you may be able to build community that deals with people's sufferings, deals with their issues of life, and helps them become responsible people living in life. And that's what a prophet does. You know? And then you're always, this is pushing forward. And what happens is you hand it off like a baton so that Jesus comes and is a Messiah. Then Paul is called. It's handed on to the disciples and to Paul. And now you'll see Paul handing off the baton to people in the community, saying, you're called to do these things. So the prophetic storyline is an unfolding storyline where people are called to confront, and the results are good times, bad times, but history keeps pushing forward into the future. That's a prophetic storyline. And the storyline really begins with Abraham, where God says, go out from this place. And Abraham believed him. Then Moses is in the storyline. And so here they are on this table, the prophetic storyline. Abraham, Moses, then Elijah and Elisha were healing prophets. And Samuel, David, and then a long list of them down to Daniel. And then it comes to Jesus, who was prophetic, especially in the Gospel of Luke. And then Paul lives this prophetic storyline, and the followers are too. Now, another storyline is apocalyptic. Okay? Apocalyptic is revved up prophetic so that what happens is that regularly the heavens are in focus here. They break open and something comes down from the heavens, often in apocalyptic. With apocalyptic, you can't easily see God. Now, prophetic bridges into apocalyptic, and these blend, okay? But apocalyptic, often, now you have a seer. Rather than the emphasis being on word, which is here in the prophetic, the emphasis in apocalyptic tends to be on seeing. An apocalyptist is a seer. So there's an apocalyptic event in the life of Jesus when, after he's baptized, as he's coming out of the water, the heavens split open. In apocalyptic, the knowledge about God is hidden in the heavens, and the world itself has gotten so messed up that you can't look around in the world and see how you're supposed to act. So God has to do dramatic things from the heavens to open things up and let certain people be able to see the future. Now, and here the future is big, apocalyptic, namely the future which brings the end time to it. So with apocalyptic, there you have clear language. These are the last days. Behold. And so the heavens open and you say, well, what's going to happen? Say, well, look and see. So you have an army goes out and kills people. Well, what does all this mean? So you have to have interpretation of apocalyptic. And so apocalyptic, you have to have revelation of this. You have to have interpretation of the revelation. Often the prophetic word is very, very clear. You've got to change or you're going to be in trouble. Okay? The apocalyptic word is, look at this. See all this turmoil? These are the kinds of things that are going to happen. You know. And so this literature shows these pictures of the end time events. Apocalyptus, very much Daniel is the first apocalyptic book. But then what apocalyptic does is go back and thinks about time in the past and divides time in the past into bright and dark times. So apocalyptists look over the long span of history and they go back and they rewrite it. The first thing they are asking themselves basically is, how did history get to be such a mess? What went wrong? God created in Genesis 1 the world and said that's good. But then things went bad. How did they go bad? Well, the story that most people know is that Adam and Eve got messed up. Okay? Now, apocalyptists say, you know, I just don't think that's deep enough. I think something happened from the realm of the divine that must have messed things up even deeper than Adam. And they find a little story in Genesis 6, verses 1 through 4. In Genesis 6, God has appointed watchers over the world. Now, this is the way the apocalyptists take this little list. In chapter 6, 1 through 4, there are these huge giants that are born between the sons of God and the beautiful maidens on earth. Now, apocalyptists look at that and they say, that's where things went totally wrong. God created angels. Now, in apocalyptic, one of the first things God does is create angels. Now, that's not in the prophetic system. There are messengers of God. But now we have all these angels. You know some of their names. Michael, Gabriel, Sariel, Uriel, etc. And these angels are put in charge of watching over different things in God's world. Some watch the winds that build up storms. Others watch where earthquakes are being created. And some of them were put in charge of watching humans. Well, according to apocalyptic stories, it's the ones that appointed to watch the humans that got in trouble. Now, you can read this in the book called First Enoch, the first 16 chapters. It's not in your New Testament, but you can. It's not in your Bible, but you can click on the web and you can see it. And they say that what happened was the watchers over humans saw these beautiful, beautiful maidens that were being born to humans on earth. Now, angels, there were no women among angels, because according to First Enoch, they didn't have to have women, because angels are eternal and they're all male. But they don't have to procreate. Gabriel existed at the beginning of time. He existed at the time of Jesus. He existed at the time of Muhammad. He exists now. He always will exist. He's eternal. So they don't have to procreate. So God never made women angels, according to the apocalyptus. But these are angels with fire in them, and they see these beautiful maidens, and they go down and they procreate with them. And they give birth to these giant Nephilim beings who are half eternal spirit and half human, and these spirits go out, and then they can go into other people. And according to Apocalyptus in First Enoch, this was the birth of eternal evil in the world that started to just penetrate every fabric of God's creation. This evil that now was bloodlust evil that started to cause all humans to rise up against one another, and humans even started eating one another, and they loved to see blood so much that they would just kill others to see blood spill out on the ground. But then they would get loose in the universe and start disrupting even the rain, the sun, the moon, the stars, until they started getting into the entire fabric of the universe. Now, that's the kind of world Paul lives in. His view is that the universe has been invaded by evil powers. Because Paul is very much an apocalyptist. And this is where he thinks the Messiah is such an incredible, incredible event within the storyline of God's work with the people of Israel. Because he claims that when Jesus was killed because of the evil in society, God did not leave him dead, but performed a major action of apocalyptic belief. Okay? Apocalyptic belief was that the world, including the heavens and Sheol, were getting so evil that God was just going to decide very soon to destroy everything he had created. Now that means God would destroy the heavens, God would destroy the earth, and God would destroy Hades, Sheol, everything under the earth. But now there was a problem. What about all the faithful believers like Abraham, like Moses? Well, we don't know about Moses for sure, but Isaiah, Jeremiah, who died, David, King David, died and were buried in the earth. Okay, apocalyptic said at the time when God destroys the heavens, the earth, and that under the earth, what he would do is resurrect those who are righteous from the bowels of the earth up onto the earth. And then all the righteous would change into a form like an angelic form where they could sail through the air and they could go to the new place that God would create. In other words, God provides for the righteous not being destroyed through this new concept of the resurrection. And Paul, as a Pharisee, believed in the resurrection of the dead. The Pharisees were the liberal, forward-moving Jews of the time in this regard. They believed in angels, they believed in resurrection from the dead, and they believed in updating Torah with oral Torah. The Sadducees said no. And the Sadducees were in charge of things in the Jerusalem temple. The Sadducees said, no, there is no resurrection because it's not in the Torah. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, or Deuteronomy. But Paul believed in resurrection as a Jew. And so when Christians were saying the Messiah, Jesus Christ, was resurrected from the dead after he was killed and buried, Paul said, wow, the new age has started. God has started the new future age. And soon now, the world will come to an end, but we have to be ready for when it will come to an end. And you'll find some passages where Paul says he expects the world to come to an end very soon. It is travailing, it is groaning under its own power, and it's going to end pretty soon. And Christians later have had to deal with the fact that it didn't end like he thought. So they've had to reconfigure that so that somehow a new age was beginning in which Christians could participate. Right? But they had moved from the old age into the new age a bit before the final change of all things that will come in the future. But now you notice, we're talking about a storyline that has particular details in it that are related to a lot of things Greeks and Romans are talking about. But now we have different people. We have different ways of talking about it. We have specific belief systems that are involved in it. So Paul's focus on prophetic and apocalyptic belief systems give a new population to the gods, goddesses, heroes that are the storylines of belief that you have to pay attention to. So don't pay attention to Zeus and Hermes and Aphrodite and all these other people and Achilles and think you're going to be dealing directly with God. God has dealt directly with people. Divine communication, these are the mantic divine communication storylines that Paul introduces and along with other Christians to replace the Greek and Roman stories. Okay? There are two mantic discourses, divine communication discourses, within emerging Christianity that they develop. Prophetic and apocalyptic storylines that are the means by which God communicates with people and says, hey, this is the time, if it's apocalyptic. Here's where you are. If it's prophetic, it's you've got to go and confront people with this. So it's word and then pictures in these two. So Christianity had an answer for the Greek and Roman gods, goddesses, and heroes storylines. But that's only part of the story. Emerging Christian discourse had an answer to philosophy, which was just a major, major thing in the Greco-Roman world. And starting on page 37 here, Retzel starts talking about Stoicism and Cynic philosophy. Cynic go out kind of like prophets who confront. They confront a king and say, you know, you're not a king at all. You don't even know what a king is. You know, you just think what you need is power. But you know, a king is really a shepherd of his people. He takes care of his people. So there's a whole discussion of the nature of kingship that is at the level of moral philosophy that comes in the Jewish tradition from the Torah and wisdom of Solomon, where they live according to Torah wisdom and proverbial wisdom. So Christianity develops all kinds of answers about how a person is to live in life in a moral, philosophical way. But the other side of philosophy at the time is speculative philosophy. The kind of philosophy that says, I wonder what things were like before anything was created. What was there? Was there just darkness? Was there anything in the darkness? Was there a little spark of something that came out of the darkness? And so the pre-Socratic philosophers and other philosophers in the Greco-Roman world are working on this and have all kinds of ideas about what existed. And they have theories. And Christians say, we can tell you what's there before creation. There was God. You couldn't see Him. And then there was the reasoning and speaking power of God, the logos of God, that just emanated from God. And, you know what? That was Jesus, but you couldn't see Him then. But then later, He came down on earth. You know? And there are stories of Greek and Roman gods in which people would say, hey, that's cool. You know, that's interesting. That's different. I didn't know there was any kind of person there in that pre-creation. And Christians say, oh yeah. The one who came as Messiah existed in an invisible form, a non-fleshly form, prior to coming into the world. In other words, first century Christians were engaging in speculative philosophy and to interact in this Mediterranean world that was very much influenced by philosophers that go back to Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and pre-Socratics and a whole long line of philosophers. So this was no movement that simply was out of it in terms of understanding anything deep. No. Paul could reason with the best of them. Okay? And Christians began to reason with the best of them. They say, you have your philosophy about the world? You know, here's the true philosophy. And so later Augustine says that these stories that are the prophetic apocalyptic stories are the true stories, and the philosophy about the nature of the world is right. The only thing Greeks don't know is that the demiurge, the demiurgos, who helped God create the world, they just don't know that demiurge was the Logos, Christ, already in God and then came out of it. So they developed this philosophical view. But that's not all. Once the other part of religion... And here I'm really following a Latin writer named Varro, who published these things about 45 before Christianity on the nature of gods and humans. He said there was not only the mythical storyline mode of religion in the Mediterranean world, and not only the philosophical mode, which was right, but there's the ritual mode. Okay? And in the Mediterranean world, you had priestly mystery rituals that focused on death. So that on page 30 here in Retzel, it starts leading up to a discussion of the mystery religions on page 32. And so you have like the Eleusinian mystery, where Cory Persephone is kidnapped, and Pluto kidnaps her for the purpose of raping her. And then her mother, Demeter, makes a deal where then finally she goes down and agrees to live down with Pluto in the bowels of the earth 4 months of the year. Then 8 months of the year she'll be up on. Of course, that correlates with the growing system agriculturally, but it's dealing with death and new life to the world itself. And then the Isis-Osiris mystery, where Osiris is killed, his body is in fragments, thrown in the Nile by his brother Seth. Isis, the lover of Osiris, gathers his body back together, brings it back to life, and now they celebrate the mysteries of new life and resurrected life and revivified life through this. Well, Christianity has an answer, right? Now, these are rituals that are performed. Christianity has its answer with the ritual of the Last Supper. that remembers the death of Jesus, the burial, the resurrection. And now through priestly ritual, they eat bread and drink wine, and they have a ritual to replace these incredible rituals and processions in these mystery religions throughout the Mediterranean world. And the other side of it then is the miracle healing, where the god Asclepius has temples all over the Mediterranean world. He himself was killed, zapped with a thunderbolt when he raised a son of a king to life. But then he was taken into the heavens. So he comes down to people in their dreams in the sanctuaries and heals them. Christianity replaces this. First of all, people bring people to Jesus to be healed. Then they bring them to followers of Jesus. And it's a ritual process. And so you have a replacement. So Christianity developed this huge answer, and all these things you can see emerging in Paul's letters. And then the question is how he blends them, nurtures them, and repeoples them with himself, Timothy, Silvanus, his followers, and it goes on forward. So this is the story of six rhetoric belief systems in emerging Christianity that are functioning in three major areas: the mantic storyline, divine communication area, the philosophical area, and then the ritual area, by which Christianity works its way into the Mediterranean world and into the religious belief systems of the time. So next time, please work through PowerPoint for how are you going to identify these belief systems in statements in the New Testament, in specific verses. And those PowerPoints will show you and start taking you through those. So thank you very much.